Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, and some clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. Welcome, I'm Jeremy Mags. Coming up on the program today, a local Navy exercise sparks diplomatic tension as Iran steps back from joint drills. Eskom claims its strongest grid in 5 years, but can it survive a winter stress test? Extreme weather ahead, why the flood threat is rising in 2026, and what crowdsourced credit data reveals about South Africa's next economic risks. It's Tuesday, the 13th of January. Today, South Africa finds itself in the eye of a geopolitical storm at sea. A major multinational naval exercise, it's branded Will for Peace 2026 and hosted in South African waters, has brought warships from China, Russia and Iran all together off the Cape Coast under the expanding BRICS Plus framework. At the last minute, though, Tehran has pulled back from part of the planned exercise amid rising political tension. So let me give you some expert analysis on this. And with me is Dean Wingren, who is a defense analyst at Defense Web. Dean, always good talking to you, and thank you so much indeed. Let's start with the withdrawal. What exactly happened, and what does it tell us about the stability of this exercise?
Hi, Jeremy and the listeners, and thanks for having me back. Yes, well, this is getting curiouser and curiouser, as they say. As you mentioned, South Africa really is in the eye of a very big geopolitical storm at the moment, because not only is it exercising with sanctioned Iran, the government is under huge pressure, particularly from the U.S., to convince Iran to withdraw. And yesterday there were a number of reports and rumors from previous days saying that the South African government had actually convinced Iran to withdraw from this exercise. Yet this morning, observers over False Bay have actually observed the Iranian corvette departing from Simonstown Harbor, and all along with the other vessels that are taking part in the exercise. And it does appear that Iran has not actually distanced itself from this exercise and withdrawn, but is actually still taking an active part in it.
Dean, from a military perspective, what strategic value then does South Africa gain from an exercise such as this, beyond the, I guess, the optics of cooperation?
Well, there certainly is that optics there, whether it's the optics in this case, whether it's the optics you want on the country or is a different question. But from the Navy's point of view, there are huge benefits of having these international and foreign navies visiting our shores as well as us visiting theirs, because you get an opportunity to learn from each other. You've got lessons learned and establishing communication protocols. So when you meet on the high seas during a search and rescue mission, on an anti-piracy mission, for example, you've already established those basics of working together. And then obviously the better an ally you are, the greater the cooperation and those exercises become. In this particular case, it's more of a getting to know you type of exercise and basic formation keeping. But I think there's also an element of anti-piracy boarding exercises, and even a gunnery warning has been issued for the Southern False Bay.
But the difficulty here is, one, it either makes the South African National Defence Force more capable, but there is a risk, I guess, of normalising interoperability with forces that will have conflicting global agendas. And most notably, we've seen a very sharp reaction, for instance, from the United States to that, with warnings from Donald Trump today saying that countries doing business with Iran will now face a 25% tariff.
Trump has long made it known that he's very anti-BRICS. And BRICS was established purely as a commercial and economic grouping. It's a diverse group of the original founders, a diverse group of countries that do not share the same political ideologies. In fact, they don't, even those that share borders are sometimes have clashes between them. Yet they recognize the benefits of international commerce and trade, you know, that benefits their own countries. It is certainly not an political grouping, and most definitely not a military alliance. Yet we've seen a gradual morphing in recent years as the BRICS name expands and now into BRICS Plus. There's this morphing of the grouping more to a political sort of statements, which and South Africa, as you say, is in a very difficult geopolitical stance at the moment. It's has trade still undergoing trade negotiations with the US. A AGOA agreement is being voted on as we talk, and it places South Africa in a very difficult position with its major trading partners being the US, Europe. And, you know, China is not really the issue, but certainly sanctioned Russia and Iran, which has made it known that they are at war with NATO, the US, and the West.
What about the argument, Dean, that the language that we're hearing, particularly coming from Pretoria about peace and maritime security and cooperation, in fact masks a deeper political or geopolitical alignment? And that's fundamentally what this is about. There must be some substance, surely, to that claim.
No, I firmly believe that there is. It's all about geopolitics and the optics of that. And I believe that has superseded the sort of, can I say, innocent in quotation marks nature of these maritime exercises. And it's now something a lot more than that. And, you know, these exercises are being led by China. And the invitations to the other nations were issued by China. South Africa is just providing the facilities, as it were. But the optics is that it's a very narrow distinction for the wider community. And all the people see is South Africa exercising and being visited by these countries that are at odds with its trading partners.
I take your point about us providing the venue. Maybe I'm being very cynical here, but do we actually have a capable and functioning navy that can play its part in an exercise of the scope?
Yes and no. It's no secret that the South African Navy has been horribly defunded over the last decades, as the rest of the Defence Force. So its ability to maintain and to go and train is very, very low. So it must take every opportunity it can to go to sea and to upskill its crews and to train them and to learn what to do at sea. And that is why these exercises are so valuable, because it gives them the opportunity to do that. These exercises, you know, they're not very convoluted exercises, so it's well within the capability of the South African Navy. We're contributing one frigate and one inshore patrol vessel. And that's pretty much, you know, what the Navy can do at this time.
Dean Wingren, thank you very much indeed, defense analyst at Defense Web.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at midday.
South Africa is back at work, and Eskom tells us the grid is in its best shape in 5 years, the utility claiming an extra 4,400 megawatts on tap compared to this time last year. Unplanned breakdowns have almost halved, diesel spending down by millions, the energy availability factor is pushing steadily higher. But my question is this genuine structural improvement or just a well-timed summer reprieve? And what is turning the corner actually mean for the industry, for investment and households? Well, let's give you a view from Eric Shunmagum, who is General Manager in the Office of the Group Executive for Generation at Eskom. Eric, a very warm welcome to you. So let me wade straight in. This recovery, is it structural or seasonal? South Africans have been burned before by summer stability followed by winter chaos. What proves that things are different this time?
Jeremy, this is definitely a structural improvement. If you really go back to what has happened over the last 32 months, sometimes back in March 2023, we had the Generation Recovery Plan approved. And this plan specifically looked at addressing plant issues, plant defects. It looked at addressing the leadership gaps. And then lastly, it looked at some of the process flaws that needed to be enabled. And in that recovery plan, at that stage, if you remember, the energy availability factor was hovering around 54%. We identified six power stations that were contributing close on to 70% of the breakdowns. And through these, you know, structural reforms, it was run like a project through a recovery office. I think the first thing is I need to also highlight the appointment of the new board together with the appointment of some of the new leadership and displacing the right leaders to the right stations, because some of the stations were more complex. So some of the more experienced power station managers were dispatched. And the resultant has been, through these reforms, we've recovered close to 8 gigawatts in terms of breakdown. So, and the context is, Jeremy, if you go back to the facts, some 32 months ago, we were sitting around 18,000 megawatts of breakdowns. As I speak to you today, we sort of hovering around 8,000 megawatts in breakdowns. And this resultant, you know, has meant a much more reliable and stable supply. And then building up on what you said, I think over December, we definitely do see demand as schools and the industry shut down. But more importantly, with us having a reliable supply, we could put quite a lot of units into cold reserve capacity. We could still use the system operator, use the renewable resources. And now as we move into the demand peaking over the next week or two, these units have come up nicely. And as I said, right, we've reported this 4,400 additional capacity onto the grid compared to last year this time.
All right, let me ask you this then. You say the EAF, the energy availability factor, has risen from 56% to above 64%, and occasionally, Eric, even over 70%. Why are we not seeing a constant 70% if your plan that you've just outlined to me is truly delivering?
So, Jeremy, I think that's one of the issues. We've compacted with both the board and the shareholder at 70%. And if you really look at, you know, where we've come from, considering a lot of maintenance was done in previous years, so it was planned maintenance. We will now stabilize our maintenance around 10%. We can plan this over the year. And what we should be doing, you know, we've reported 55 occasions of us being around exceeding 70%. So this specific target, we will see actually increase and move towards 70%. The challenge that we have, Jeremy, which I must highlight technically, with this high availability factor, it means we've got excess capacity and it will mean us putting units into cold reserve. So I think it's important from a system operator point of view. It's a nicer problem to solve for with us having sufficient capacity. It does come with some other negatives because, you know, getting new projects approved and justifying it becomes a bit more of a challenge. But I think in coming months, as we move into the new year, we will move towards the 70%.
Eric, South Africa still, and you'll agree with me, lacks enough new generation capacity in the pipeline. And I've got to wonder whether Eskom risks overselling improvements while the underlying supply deficit still remains unresolved.
Jeremy, I think you're spot on. So there's two aspects to this. One is, I think when you looked at the Energy Action Plan, You know, the easiest way to get the megawatts was to get the improvement in the plans, and hence the focus on the generation recovery plan. But to solve South Africa's problems, we're going to have to look at new capacity. And the minister has made pronouncements on the new capacity, lots of renewables, there's nuclear, there's gas. I think for me, what's important is the actual execution of these plans, you know, having these plans constructed and implemented in time as per the IRP 2025. And then the other dimension is the rollout of the transmission infrastructure. You know, it's important, you could have the generation capacity around the country, but you'll need to get the strategic servitudes to this capacity. And with the new capacity, then we start to solve the actual country's problems.
Mm. Eric, you're talking a strong game here, but I would also put to you the turnaround has been heavily funded by the 250 billion rand debt relief package. So let me ask you bluntly, without that bailout, would any of this improvement have been possible?
So Jeremy, I think one has to be very honest that the 254 has definitely helped on actually the balance sheet. It has made a massive difference. But what it's allowed us to do in terms of our tariff, it's allowed us to give more to the generation recovery. If you really look at what we've done over the last 32 months, quite a substantial amount of money has gone into outage maintenance. If you really look at last year, this time our planned maintenance was sitting around 16-17%. If you really look at year to date, we're sitting at a planned maintenance around 11%. So one of the key enablers, you know, when I talked about the three dimensions, we had to address the people issues, the plant issues, and the process. And in the process, funding was critical. And this funding was definitely made available to enable the success of the recovery plan.
Thank you very much indeed. I've been in conversation with Eric Chumangum, who is General Manager in the Office of the Group Executive for Generation at Eskom. Eric, appreciate your time. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa is heading into a wetter, storm-heavier 2026, and meteorologists are warning that while cooler temperatures may offer a degree of relief from the heat, the increased rainfall brings a much more serious threat, flooding across large parts of the country's interior. Now, the latest climate modelling, as I understand it, points to persistent wet spells, soil saturation, and a higher mobility or probability of flash floods, particularly in vulnerable provinces where infrastructure, I don't need to tell you, is already strained and disaster management plans are inconsistent, under-resourced. Well, let's explore this in a little more detail. And obviously, all of this has a very serious impact on the economy. Meteorologist at the University of Pretoria, Professor Willem Landman, a very warm welcome to you. The modelling shows a definite increase in rainfall for this year. Are there specific regions then, let's start with this, that are now at the highest risk of flooding?
Yeah, so we've had good rains the past few months over this current summer rainfall season. And the forecasts are that this may continue for the larger part of the summer period. So when we've had quite a bit of rain already and more rain is expected to come, then obviously that increases the chances of local flooding events.
You're saying is that good rain isn't always good news, is it?
No, not really. It depends on your perspective. You know, in terms of the user, they want good rain help agriculture. But if it rains too much, you know, that's also not good for agriculture. We've had good examples where farmers have actually had low yields because of too much rain. So that happens. But in terms of a modeling perspective, if we predicted the season to be wet, then we really want the season to be wet. From our perspective, we want it to be a very wet season.
Professor, we all know that this country has had catastrophic floods in the last decade. Are lessons learnt or are there lessons that have been ignored when it comes to planning for 2026 and beyond?
I think more and more people are becoming aware of the fact that these forecasts have value. There's always going to be people who ignore them because there are cases where forecasts have not been as useful as they have been perceived to be. So sometimes forecasts, even when the forecasts are confident, they don't always turn out to be true. But for the most part, this is something that we have established through verification of forecasts over many, many years. We've seen that for the most part, forecasts are actually quite useful and quite can be used to the advantage of whoever's interested in forecasts.
Disaster management strategies, Professor, vary widely, I think it's fair to say, between provinces. Have you put your finger on maybe which provinces are least prepared and where the most urgent interventions are needed to be implemented as soon as possible to prevent any kind of disaster or catastrophe?
Yeah, from a climate modelist perspective, that's going to be a very difficult question to answer. But what I can tell you is that when there's communities that are vulnerable, for example, if you have people who live close to the rivers, you know, and so when there's flooding, those people are impacted directly. So people drown because they live too close to river systems. And how disaster management actually deals with that is something I don't really know, but it's something that they should do. And it doesn't really help to just act when we have a situation of high rainfall. We should be proactive, make sure that people don't live too close to these rivers that can flood.
I mean, that's the great tragedy, isn't it? That informal settlements always or inevitably are at the front line of any kind of climate disaster.
That is definitely the case. It's definitely the more vulnerable people of our society that have suffered the most from climate events that bring lots of flooding, even droughts.
Professor Landmann, all of this, of course, has potential dire economic consequences. And you alluded to this a little bit earlier in the conversation, that while wetter conditions are positive for drought-stricken areas, there is also the danger of things like soil saturation and repeated rainfall on already unstable land. And this would make the agricultural sector very nervous.
Yeah, most definitely. Like I said before, it can be that too much rain can be detrimental to a farmer's economy, that he's trying to make use of forecast that says this is going to be a nice season, we get lots of rain. Unfortunately, our forecasts can't really say if it's going to be one of those seasons where you get like 3 or 4 times the standard deviation or the average rainfall. You can only say this is likely to be a wet season. And so farmers think, okay, they're predicting a wet season. That means I should make use of the fact that we may get good rain. So they invest lots of money in trying to buy more seeds and maybe buy a new tractor or two. And then it rains too much. So it can definitely have a serious financial impact if it's too wet.
And Professor, these shifting rainfall patterns that you talk about, it all part of, I imagine, a longer term climate trend for South Africa. It's not a temporary anomaly in the climate cycle, is it?
Well, that is a very loaded question. So if you are talking about rainfall, my experience is that we have not really seen much change in rainfall trends. Maybe we forget the fact that we live in an area where there's huge rainfall variation. So if we have seasons of high inundation or seasons of little rainfall, it's not necessarily something that's outside the natural cycles. It's more, my experience is that when we start talking about temperatures have a much stronger signal related to something like anthropogenic climate change. But in terms of the rainfall extremes, I'm not entirely convinced that it's always to do with climate change. I know a colleague of mine at Wits University, and him and his colleagues have written a paper that talked specifically about the flooding events in KZN of about a year or two ago. And their research has shown that climate change has actually made that particular impact worse. So that is an example where research has actually shown where a particular rainfall event may have been enhanced as a consequence of climate change. But in general, we must always remember that we have always had in the past severe flooding events, like the kind of event that's now being predicted for parts of Kruger National Park and such.
I'm going to leave it there. Professor Willem Landmann, appreciate your time, meteorologist at the University of Pretoria.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa may be entering a stronger nominal growth phase this year, but under the surface, credit risk is becoming a little more uneven, with widening dispersion, pockets of stress and early signs of contagion that traditional indicators often miss. And that's interesting. Crowdsourced credit intelligence, aggregated from institutions with real exposure, is increasingly being used to spot the returns before they show up in financial statements or market spreads. I want to explore this in a little more detail. I'm in conversation now with Mark Faulkner, who's co-founder of Credit Benchmark, to tell us what the crowd is seeing and what South Africa's next risks might be. So, Mark, a very warm welcome. So, at headline level, I think it's fair to say the outlook is improving, but you make the point that risk dispersion is widening. Why is that happening, and what are the early danger signals the crowd is picking up that maybe traditional data isn't?
Thank you for having me, and it's an interesting question. Thank you. The one thing I've learned over the 10-year journey of Credit Benchmark is that notwithstanding the propensity to model things and look to spreadsheets and technology, credit remains an art. Mm. It's more art, or at least as much art as it is science. And so there is a range and diversity of opinion within the banking community and increasingly the non-banking community that are an important part of the credit process. What we've done over the last decade, and we've been very proud to be of service to the South African banking community for 7 or 8 years now, is to gather data from those with skin in the game, banks who make the credit decisions, to help them understand whether their view of the credit environment is conservative or cavalier, early or late. You've probably never met a cavalier banker. Mm. They all think they're conservative. But wouldn't it be interesting to know what the sentiment is of your peers with regard to the markets that you're exposed to, the industries you're exposed to? We are aggregators of the consensus view that comes in from those with skin in the game. We don't have a credit view ourselves. So I couldn't stand back and tell you, we think that credit is deteriorating or changing because of mm-hmm. this, that, or that. What we can do is to indicate that the range of opinion is changing. Over the last decade, the world of credit risk, and since particularly COVID, has been rather benign. The largesse and generosity of the central banks, of the politicians, of the banking community to ensure liquidity for the world has meant that very few organizations have actually gone bust. You need to work quite hard to go bust at this moment in time and over recent times. But there's a growing sense that this will change. And you can see that in the data. That's what we're picking up, is that we're starting to see the beginnings of a dispersion of opinion.
So let's talk a little bit about that dispersion. I think the key phrase here is skin in the game,
yes.
Because the data is real. The data is authentic. So what's the general sense about South Africa's resilience right now? What is strengthening? And are you able to tell us where the stress is starting to build quietly?
It's interesting. The overall story remains positive. Which is, you know, a theme you've mentioned a couple of times. And we don't see any reason to challenge that positivity. This is a very well-banked market. There's a great deal of competition here. I think one has to be impressed by the standard of the SARB's oversight and prudential oversight of the market here. And I don't think there are any particular areas of concern here in South Africa. What we've picked up on is a great interest from the South African banks to start being of service to the continent in general. That they are increasingly keen to be the providers of finance and liquidity and credit north of South Africa, for want of a better way of putting it. And the data that we've gathered shows that we can see more and more activity in the continent, and that the willingness of the banks to be on the front foot and in the light of shadow banking, non-banking lending competition, they're being more ambitious continentally as well as they are here in South Africa.
All, of course, against the backdrop of a global picture.
Yes.
And one of your themes is contagion risk. What kinds of contagion pathways then are starting to emerge?
I think that the competition that the banking sector is facing from the private credit market. I think it used to be called the shadow banking market, but now I think one could call it the private credit market is huge. And one of the things that the banking community has always done is sought to be at the conservative, not cavalier, basis. And so the data set that we provide to them and is aggregated from 40-plus banks, half of which are G-SIBs globally, enables them to ensure that the underwriting standards that they are pursuing and maintaining are appropriate with their risk appetite. Sometimes the best deal you do all day is the deal you don't do. So it's knowing when to say no. It's knowing to be sensitive to the outliers. Risk isn't always where you think it is. I think it would be imprudent of us to say there's a particular sector of the market that's vulnerable. But I think it would be fair to say that the competition from the lighter regulated private credit sector is something that's making all chief risk officers, all chief credit officers, all heads of modeling sit up and take notice. They are deeply responsible for protecting their organizations. They are, in my experience, in our experience, very curious individuals. And most of them have the confidence to admit that they don't know everything. That's when we can be of a service to them. If you don't recognize the responsibility, if you aren't curious and you aren't confident enough to admit that you don't know everything, you can't learn anything.
Curiosity is one thing, but all of this is underpinned by data. You've doubled, I understand, coverage in South Africa.
Yes.
So you have an expanded data set.
Yes.
What are you able to allow banks, insurers, and asset managers to see now that maybe they couldn't see 12 months ago?
The primary difference has been that we've added a couple of significant commercial banking data sets to our consensus, and that's really lit up the data set. It's not only lit it up within the South African market, but to the extent that that commercial data that was missing hitherto, that's now been added to, is lighting up Africa as well. So it was commercial banking data. We typically start with the investment banking, larger institutional names. We had a couple of pockets of commercial banking data, which we began wheedling out, for want of a better word, began bringing on board in conversations a year ago. We're now here to sort of almost take a lap of honor, having received that data locally and continentally to light up the data set.
And that's where we are going to leave it. Mark Faulkner, co-founder, Credit Benchmark. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And you've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.